I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
Ah, it's so good to be here. I would love to thank Marilyn, that full of life, big smiled, howling like the wolf secretary of ours. I love her a lot, and we have a lot of fun at the yard playing volleyball. And it is a little disconcerting when the Wednesday night secretary serves the ball and throws her head back and howls to the moon. But it's never a dull moment, I'll tell you. If you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to be bored. Life is just starting for you. If you stay sober in between meetings, come to a lot of meetings, grab a sponsor, and start working these steps, because 18 years, 8 months, and 28 days ago, my life started here with you. And I've grown up here. This is my family of understanding. And I look around the room and I see so many faces, and there's so many memories attached to so many of you. So I don't think I'll look at any of you right now, get stuck on somebody. But you know, my day started out in the usual fashion, which is hitting the floor running and reading, doing a little reading, and I finished spray painting a volcano for my son. He was working on that for school, and then we took pictures of that, and he went off to school, and he kisses me goodbye in the car now. He won't kiss me goodbye on the schoolyard. He's 9 and a half, so it's not cool. And then I went to court, and I represented the firm I work for as their document and record verifier, and I shook hands with the defendant, smiled at him, and I was sworn in and winked at the judge and just had a good time. And but in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've become free. And I was thinking of that today as I was sitting there in this stilted courtroom about just the joy of life that I feel. And it's because I've come to a place in my life now where I have come to God, and that's by working the 12 steps. I have become a complete human being in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was not that way when I was brought into the world, I don't think. I come from a normal family with normal 52-year married parents and sisters and brother that are all normal, professional, successful, happy people. And there was me, and I was very nervous until I had my first drink. And at 13 years old, I discovered something that changed my life forever, and that was that alcohol filled those holes in me that I had. It quieted my wild head that wouldn't shut up. All those people up there got drunk. And I drank for a lot of years because it worked, and we had a good time. And as I was thinking back, my parents had a 50th anniversary recently. And when I went home to that 50th anniversary, and I looked at all those townspeople that showed up, because about 500 townspeople showed up, and the country club was packed. And I was looking around all those people that I was raised with, and I didn't feel as much a part of them as I feel a part of you, because they are not people that ever understood me. And until I came to you, that was always one of my big rebel cries as I shook my fist. Fist in one hand, one finger in the next. You don't understand. And nobody did understand. I was a lone rebel, and that's the way I liked it. And alcohol fueled that fire for me. And after dropping out of college, fighting with my father, shaking my fist at the Catholic Church, I ended up taking geographics in New York and back to art school. And no more art talent was left. That ran out my sleeve. It was something that I drank up, and I ended up in Colorado and met Bob Dylan, came to California, not sure if it's Bob Dylan, but ended up at a commune, had a great time. And at 21 years old, I landed back at home with Mom and Dad, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. Nobody is looking for the disease of alcoholism in my life. It's just if Sharon just could get off those drugs and maybe just meet a nice guy and calm down and go to work. And it was the 60s. It was the just say thanks generation. We had a good time. And we took a lot of drugs with our alcohol, but my mother asked me not to drink or not to take drugs in the house. So I went and drank in those taverns, and I drank every night. And I was very sick, and I was dying, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And somebody said they'd take care of me, and I ended up at a commune in northern Wisconsin, which was not my idea of a vacation, because we worked hard. And we heard Don. We have 50 head of sheep, Don, organic sheep there. So everything was organic. They made me organic. They took away my alcohol. They tried to help me control and enjoy my drinking, which wasn't much fun at all. I smoked organic pot from morning to night. Eventually, I had some surgery, and the doctor looked at me and said, "What's wrong with you? You have a 21-year-old body, but you have the body of an old woman. And you have pancreatitis. Your gallbladder is not functioning. You're terribly toxic." And I looked at him and I said, "I'm organic. I don't take drugs." know, I don't abuse myself. And that's what I thought was wrong with me, was that, you know, there was just this physical side of me, which was my alcoholism. It was already full-blown and working on my body at 21 years old. I could have walked in the doors easily, but there was one thing missing in my life, surrender. There was no surrender in my life at 21 years old. That was still fast and furious. Those people blackballed me. I ended up raising a half acre of organic pot, trying to sell it. I forgot the pot, so I joined the carnival that night. And it was really that simple. It was that simple of a move. Norm Alpe used to talk a lot about the reason the grass was greener was because the other guy took care of his lawn. You know, I never knew that. I just went from place to place and person to person and thing to thing, and my backpack was packed and my dog was at my heels, or one of my dogs. My poor dogs always kept getting killed or dying, or something kept happening to my... I felt worse about my dogs and my turtle who crawled through my cocaine and died one night than I ever felt about some of the people I hurt in my life until I got sober. But yeah, I wasn't good with animals at all until I got to sobriety. But so I joined this carnival, and my father and I don't talk now. My mother cries when I call home, and I ended up being a shooting gallery girl, you know, and ripping off little kids and drinking my tequila, and my dog, who was nice, started to bite people, you know, and I was nasty and arrogant, and I made a lot of fights happen, and eventually I just got busted for drugs is what happened in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and it wasn't a fun place to go to jail, and I ended up in there for 31 days. My father came to visit me at this time. Now, we hadn't spoken to each other in years. You know, my dad and I couldn't pass in the hallway at the same time. We couldn't sit at the same table and eat together. We couldn't ride in the same car. It was too painful for my father to even look at me. And I broke my dad's heart, but I'm not hurting anybody but myself. That's another self-centered, selfish, self-obsessed alcoholic cry. And that's what I felt for a lot of years. But it hurt when my dad was there that day. You know, he sat there, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and we couldn't talk to one another. And it was one of those days I wish I could have just evaporated. I was in handcuffs. I looked disheveled. I was a mess. And, you know, they didn't have that in mind for daughter number two, but nobody knew alcoholism. And I just felt like I was a bad person. And one of the biggest recollections I have in my early sobriety was going to the Palm Springs Desert Roundup. And I remember hearing a woman named Gloria talk that we're not bad people looking to get good here. We're sick people trying to get well. And it took so much of that stigma off the disease of alcoholism for me. I finally realized I was sick, but I felt like a bad person for a lot of years. You know, I said goodbye to God a long time before. I didn't want God to know where I was. I just wanted to keep moving. And I ended up in New Orleans, where I found love. You know, you can drink anywhere in that town. And I fell in love with New Orleans, and I danced on a baby grand piano. I wore platinum blonde wigs. I wore fishnet stockings, platform shoes, and me and my skunk would walk down Bourbon Street to work. And that's the way I lived. I had a wonderful boyfriend that used to give me black eyes on a daily basis. He'd pass out from heroin, and I'd give him a kick or two in his face, you know. And that was my true love. That's what I thought it was all about. The last time my parents visited me was when I was living with that guy, and you know, he put the snake in my dad's face upon meeting him. My mother cried into her baked potato. They tried to talk to me, and you know, they had no idea that I was as bad as I was, and they just, any resemblance of the daughter they had raised was gone. She was dead. She was gone. When my parents drove away that day to go back to Iowa, my heart broke, because it was over between me and my family. And I sat in a bar, and I ordered another rock glass full of tequila, because that was just going to put the fire out. And I ordered another, and I ordered another. And, you know, I felt so bad, and it wouldn't, the fire wouldn't go out that day. I remember alcohol betrayed me that day, because I still felt so bad about who I was and what my life was. When I'd look in that back bar mirror, Lauren Bacall was not appearing anymore, I can tell you that. And I drank a long time in New Orleans. I drank for 3.5 more years, and my blackouts got worse. And I would wake up in other states with people I didn't know, driving on freeways the wrong way. And I was doing things that were in violent situations, and I didn't care anymore. I stopped caring. There was a part of me somewhere that just stopped caring. And I just drank because I had to drink. It's all I knew to do was to drink, and the life around drinking. My last job in that city was tending bar on Lower Decatur Street, where you couldn't... It wasn't on the tourist stops, you know. It's just one of those places you can smell the bathroom and the mints in the bathroom as you're walking down the street. You know you're coming to a seedy little bar. Even my drinking friends wouldn't come visit me there. It was that bad. Only if they had to, because I had been to their bar for about 5 times in a row. And My friend was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day in 1975, and I was in a blackout. He was 2 feet to the left. I should have been standing next to him. I don't know why I was 2 feet inside the door, and he was 2 feet to the left. A speaker named Norm Alpe used to talk a lot when I was new, and he talked about seconds and inches. And we've all got our stories of seconds and inches, that we get to be the lucky ones to put our fanny in a seat of Alcoholics Anonymous, because not everybody gets here. Not everybody who wants to be here tonight gets to be here. And it's just a gift to be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up running to New York, and that's all I knew to do. I ran to California, and I ended up in Barney's Beanery, where I saw the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in my life. And it was under a girl's arm named Chris, and she was drunk, and she had to call a taxi to take her to her A&A meeting. And she was couldn't even walk out the door. She had that black book under her arm, and I took my rock glass full of tequila, and I wished her well. And little did I know that Chris was going to, on August 20th, be there for me when I called. And Chris is dead from alcoholism. The last time I saw her was when we had the St. John's Hospital meeting on Saturday night. She was in a wheelchair at that meeting, and she was drooling on herself. And she didn't know me anymore. And she was 30 years old. And that's the seriousness of the disease. I got to see it face to face that night. And she's not here. But she got me here. I got on the back of a Harley-Davidson and went to Palm Springs. It was July 27th, 1975. And as I was leaving the nightclub, and they started to drive away, I said, hey, I thought we were going to have a good time and party. And they said, no, we needed a little extra weight for the back tire. So we looked around Barney's, and we found the fattest one, and that was you. So thanks a lot for the extra weight. We'll see you. And they drove off. And not to be undaunted, I went in the bar and found two of the skinniest guys in there. And I guess I met them and took them somewhere. And when I came to, they were kicking me in the face with their boots and raping me, and they broke my jaw in three places that night. And it wasn't one of those sleeping DTs I had had. It wasn't one of those situations where I'm going to cry my way out of, you know, or punch my way out of, or whatever it took for me to get out of those situations. I was a survivor, and I got out of those situations. But something happened that night as they were doing what they did to me. I gave up. There was a voice inside of me that just said, who the hell cares anyway? And I died. Me as I know it, died. And they took me outside of town and rolled me off the side of the road, where you wouldn't have seen me if you drove by. I was face down in the sand, bleeding from my face. I had no clothes on. It was hot. It was desert. I had a concussion, and I should have baked, and I would have been history. But something happened. I heard the car door slam, and I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up. I want to live. I thought, who said that? I didn't say that. I didn't care about living. I had given up. But something happened, and I heard it, and I got up, and I guess I went down the road, and I guess I found a lawn chair in somebody's condominium in their backyard by their pool, because the gardener found me about 6:30 in the morning and called the police and called an ambulance, and I ended up in the hospital. And when I was in that hospital that morning being prepared for surgery, something happened. My identity was there in that hospital that day. As I was writing on that clipboard, because I couldn't talk, my face was hanging off, I was writing where I was and who I was with, those hard questions they were asking me. And I saw in front of my name a word that made my heart stop, made me smile if I could have smiled, and the word was victim. And I thought, my God, they finally know. It was my identity. That was all that was left, was victim. And I was really happy for a moment. And then I had that voice come back as they're wheeling me into surgery. That voice said, you know what, your dad didn't put you here in the gurney. George, who broke your heart at 18, didn't do it. Your sister, the Mensa, that Catholic church. Yeah. You did this to you. And I didn't know what to do with truth. I had taken hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD and looked for truth in every crevice and corner and under everything and on top of everything. But there was truth being said to me that day. You did this to you. And I knew it was true, and I didn't know what to do with it. Something was happening to me. I was being psychically changed and readied for Alcoholics Anonymous, because earlier, a couple of hours earlier, I had said those words, which were very quiet, but those words which were so important for me, which were, I give up. I give up. And the surrender was able to happen. And I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I started to live above the liquor store over in Overland and Palms, the Duck Pond liquor store. They had to, they caught the guys. I had to go to court. I had to go back to these doctors and surgeons. And, you know, I didn't have it in me anymore to stick out my thumb and start over in Phoenix, Arizona. It was over. I had no more of that fight in me. And I sat there in that seedy apartment above that liquor store, and the guy would buy me red wine every day before he'd go off to work. And I'd stick a straw into that after he'd, you know, unscrew the cheap bottle of wine, and stick a straw through the wires in my mouth where the tooth had been, and I would suck on the red wine all day long. And there was no more fun in it. I wasn't drinking for fun. I was maintaining. There was no more warmth in it. There was no more party in it. There was no more good time in it. There was no more Lauren Bacall in it. There were no more dreams or hope in it. I was just drinking alcohol because I had no choice. I had no choice. And on August 20th, he said, "You've got to leave. You're too depressing." Me? And I called my mother. And my mother said to me, after she didn't know for two nights how her daughter was, she got a panicked phone call from somebody in the hospital who said I had been raped, beaten up, this had happened. And then they hung up and didn't tell her what hospital I was in. So my poor mother in Iowa for two nights didn't sleep and called hospitals frantically until she found me. And when I called my mom on that day, I'm a mom. I would have done anything, anything. But what my mother said was, "Sharon, I can't help you anymore. You better go to the Salvation Army." And boy, I know seconds and inches at that moment that I was even going to get to you, because if my mom would have sent $20, you'd have another speaker, because she had to let me go. See, the surrender was in process. It was happening for me. And I called that girl, Chris, from Barney's Beanery, because she was nice to me. And Chris said, "Oh, yeah, I know someone that can help you." And she gave me the woman named Suzanne, this phone number of Suzanne. Chris wasn't sober that day, but she got me to somebody who was sober in this group about 5 years. And I called Suzanne, and Suzanne said, "Well, don't drink anything and don't smoke anything either, you know." And I had to put my joint down and put my glass down like she was standing behind me. She read my mail. She sent two of her babies over to get me, and there I sat. On the steps, I just drove by there yesterday, on the steps by that liquor store with my broken huaraches, my ripped jeans, my bleach-stained T-shirt, my wired, crooked face, my nose off to the side, my hair not combed, smelling terrible. And these two beautiful women get out of this car and start walking towards me, and I just thought, what do they want from me? You know, the arrogance I had. And I got in the back seat, and I'll tell you, they were sincere because I know I smelled bad. They were very sincere. And they talked incessantly about themselves, and they brought me to the Echo Park meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on Wednesday night, where the Pacific group used to meet, back when we had the Wednesday night meeting Tuesday night. And I walked into that meeting, and there was a man standing there with a nice suit and a tie on. And I thought he was going to say, "Oh, my God, you look terrible. Let's put you in the back or in the kitchen until we clean you up." That's what I thought he was going to say to me. And what he said to me was, "Welcome." He just said one word, which is welcome. And they sat me in front. I don't know how they knew I was new, but I got a lot of attention. A lot of attention. And many of you were here that are here tonight were there then. That night, you were there. And it makes me feel so safe when I come here that I see people that were there that night. I don't remember. They tell me they remember. I don't remember anything coming here for 2 weeks. I was so out of it. I had a wired-up jaw, so I couldn't talk the first 3 months I was here, so that was a blessing. I had to learn to listen, and nobody called on me to share or read the 12 traditions or anything. It was just fine. But I didn't know how they knew I was new. I got all this attention. I passed with 17. I passed the 20 questions with 17, and I didn't know what this was all about, and the man said one thing that I identified with. He gave me a little bit of hope, because he said he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, "You can come home now, Bill." And I identified, because I had looked for that mothership for years when I was a little girl. And I knew they let me off. And that's all I remember. And they took me home, and their sponsors had told them, "Now wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before you send her upstairs." So these girls, whoever took me home from whatever meeting when I lived above that liquor store, had to sit there in the car with this non-speaking, maudlin, smelling alcoholic and tell me parts of their story over and over again. And I didn't know why they wouldn't let me out of the car. I had no idea that that's what their sponsors had told them to do. You know, and I have it on good information that the old-timers were hoping I was going to make it, but they were hoping they didn't have to get too involved. So they sent their babies over to work with me. I had a lot of people in their first various months of sobriety working with me. I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better at all. Marianne reminds me of the time she said, I knew you were going to make it when I saw you at Ohio Stream one night and the light was shining on your hair, and I nudged Pat and I said, "Look, maybe Sharon will make it. She washed her hair." And that's what it was like. I wasn't raised like that. I knew how to take care of myself, but I didn't care anymore. I had stopped caring. Alcohol had taken it all from me, and I had given it to King Alcohol freely. And I didn't care anymore about myself. But you cared. And that was something I think I started to feel. I was told that I looked tired. Someone said, "You look tired. Take your pack off and stay with us for a while." I thought, how does he know I'm tired? You know, I thought you were so wise. I didn't understand a day at a time. That had to be explained to me, how to live in the moment. I didn't think I could make rides to tomorrow night's meeting because it wasn't a day at a time. and it had to be explained to me. But the people were kind to me. Nobody laughed at me, and nobody said, oh, that's a stupid question, leave. If you're new, ask lots of questions. It's a great place to be. You can ask whatever you want. And it started for me here, and little did I realize that it was God's grace that took away the desire for alcohol. There I was, 31 days sober. I didn't have to raise my hand anymore, and I didn't even miss it. I didn't even miss it. I beat my fist on the bars down in New Orleans to get a drink. I mean, I knew I had, my life was made when I walked into my favorite bar with my rock glass full of tequila sitting out there and my piano player playing my song, which was a good victim song. It was You Made Me Love You. And that was, I knew I had it made when that happened, you know? And I didn't even miss it. I didn't miss the life. I was so tired that I was numb. And that's how it started for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got a sponsor because somebody made me. There was a lot of peer pressure. There's not a lot of members of the class of 75 around, but there's a few of us. But, you know, Pat is one of them. I used to stand in mood lines between Pat Y and Betty A. And that was where my spot was in the move line, because we stood by sobriety, and I started to feel secure between those two of them. You know, and Pat got more attention than me, and I was really kind of sorry that her husband was dying of cancer, but she had a lot more attention than me. So I would stay sober at Pat, because I didn't want to have less time than Pat. So I always stayed sober because I wanted to be ahead of Pat in that move line. She kept me sober a lot in my first year. Doesn't matter what keeps you here. Absolutely doesn't matter in the beginning what keeps you here, you know, because you have to go from admittance to acceptance. And I had to admit I was an alcoholic to stay here, but I didn't accept it for a long time until I started working the steps with a sponsor. And I think the first significant step I really remember working with her was step 3. And I did it on her living room floor with the curtains open, the sun shining in, the kids running in and out, and we read it out of this big book. We jumped up and she gave me the longest hug. And it felt so good, I knew I must be gay, because it felt so good coming from this other woman. I didn't know what it felt like to be loved anymore. And she was loving me. And Janet gave me a lot of love. The first 4 years I was here, Janet sponsored me. And she kept me from running because I was an angry person. I remember I was going to run and go to Las Vegas and have my slip at 11 months of sobriety. And she told me the Stella story. And I think they go to sponsor school, but she told me the Stella story. And the Stella story is, fine, go off and have your slip. Don't finish your inventory like my friend Stella. She didn't finish her inventory either. And she burned up in a bed on her slip. But go have fun. Go have a good time, you know. And when your sponsor tells you that as you're standing at the terminal ready to go to Las Vegas, you know, it kind of makes you mad that she takes the wind out of your sails. So I'm going to stay sober at her another day. And I wrote my inventory. And nothing great happened when I took my fifth step other than I felt like I could sink a little deeper in my seat. I felt like I had done something that was very hard for me, trusting another human being, especially a woman, with what I had done, and walking back into a meeting and looking at her eyeball to eyeball. I felt like I had done something very hard, and I got an ounce of self-worth from doing that. I got a full ounce of self-worth from doing that, because I had none. I was an empty glass when I came to you, an empty vessel. I had no spirit. There was nothing left in me. And the way I got filled up was by working the steps. Was by being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, was by being somebody who's a giver in this group, whether I felt like it or I meant it or not, somebody who would give rides, somebody who would show up at panels, somebody who would be a GSR member, somebody who would keep her commitments. I started to rely on myself, and I became reliable. I became a responsible human being, and by becoming responsible, I became less of a victim. I had a little bit of choice in my life, and I didn't have to say, oh, poor me, as much anymore. I met and married Al. We got married when I was 2 years sober. My dad came out to the wedding. My sisters, many of you were there. We danced to Mac the Knife was the wedding song. We ate ham and cheese sandwiches. We had a great time. And my father looked at me at the end of the day and he said, Sharon, look at your life. You've got it made. He came to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and bought the big book and went home to Iowa. A woman named Ginny became my sponsor. And Ginny sponsored me for a long time. She helped me become a woman. And she helped me learn not to be afraid of that. And Ginny had me call my father and ask him if I could pay him back the money I owed him. And I said, he's forgotten about the money I owe him, and how do you know I owe him any money? It's just that sponsor school again, I think. And so I called him and I asked him, and he gave me a figure like that. I know he went home. He read the big book. He worked on it one night with a calculator, and deep in the cold night of Iowa January, and there he had it. If she calls, give her the bottom line. She will call if she works these steps. So I accepted my father's amount, and I whined to my sponsor. She said she didn't care, loving sponsor. And I sent my father off a check every month without fail, and I was not late. And she made me do that for well over 3.5 years, even on the months I didn't think I'd have it. And it was between Christmas and New Year's, 3.5 years later, that my father called me. He never called me. He never picked up the phone to call me by himself. It was always Mom calling, passing the phone to Dad. And my dad called me, and my dad said, "Sharon, I don't want any more of your money. Your debt with me is free and clear." Ginny had had me do something that was a little bit different. She asked me to please put a note about my life in with that check. I said, "I don't care about my father knowing about my life, and he doesn't care about my life either. Just leave us alone, we're fine." She said, "Put that note in with those checks," and I did that. And I did that for 3.5 years. And when my dad called me and said the debt was free and clear, he added something to that. He said, "Don't stop sending me your notes." And me and my dad got to walk into a guilt-free relationship. That relationship was based and grooved in guilt. And I got to walk into a brand new relationship and see my dad through clear eyes for the first time ever, I think, ever that I remember. I love my dad. He's a great guy. I'm a lot like him. I never knew that. And I am overpaid just in the fact that my father and mother can sleep at night and not worry if the phone rings at 2 a.m. if they've found her. I am overpaid. I am a mom today, and that means more to me than anything else, that my mom and dad can sleep at night knowing I'm safe in the Pacific group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to go to New Orleans in 1980 to the International Convention with all of you, and it was hard for me to go back there. But I got to go back there and make my amends to a town that I had just died in, and I was very afraid to do that. And I remember Maurice being with us at Brennan's for breakfast, and I remember Maurice being at my watch, and I remember my watch and what I wore, you know, when I turned one that night, when I turned one and had my watch, I remember that so clearly, what I wore, and that Maurice was there, and a lot of other people. Maurice was real important to me, too. And I was thinking about him the other day when we were walking down the street looking for my old apartment I used to live in, and Clancy was about a block behind us, and I was lost. I would have never told Clancy that, but I'm looking for the old apartment I used to live in. There's about 50 of them following me on this tour of the French Quarter of my old haunts. And Maurice kept saying, "Just keep walking, Sharon. We'll find it. Just keep walking." And it was about 110 degrees and 100% humidity, and we got there, and it was a big hallelujah, and we all blessed the place, and it was quite an experience for me to go back there and to make my amends to the people in that town and the old bosses I ripped off and the people I had hurt. And there were two women there that were very close to me. One was Robin, one was Denny. Denny didn't recognize me. She had no idea who I was until I told her who I was. Robin, I tried to 12-step, and she passed out on my bed with a big book in the Hyatt Hotel where we were staying. And I thought, I don't know if these people are ever going to make it, but I tried. You know, I'm here, and I'm just being an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And 10 years ago, I got a call from Robin that she was sober. And about 2 months later, I got a call from Denny that she had gotten sober. And these women, we died together on those streets. They wouldn't even come into that old bar that I used to work in. They didn't want to be a part of that life I was because I was such a bad alcoholic. And these women are sober today, and I get to sponsor one of them. And Denny, we're real proud of her. She's an attorney. She's quite a high-powered attorney down in New Orleans now, and she's got about 10 years of sobriety. And she found out for me this year because I was a convicted felon from that bust in Bogalusa, Louisiana, because there were so many drugs there, that I am a pardoned human being. And I get to check no on those boxes now when they say, "Have you ever been convicted of a felony?" I get to put no. And I became more of a citizen this year because of that. Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me so many freedoms. I get to work with people here, and I get to have people work with me here. I am not alone. I am the type of person that needs to be with you. I have to come and be with you to feel the joy of life. I need to see God in your eyes. I have had a marvelous experience with my higher power since I've been 7 years sober. I have gotten to sponsor Sister Sheila, and I've been able to walk back in that church and make my amends and feel free to come and go with the Catholic Church. I get to send my son to the school there so that Sister Mary can worry about him during the day. I have a great kid. He gets to tell a whole class about his mom in AA. He did that one day. I saw him the other day. I drove up, and he's twirling around on the end of the playground by himself with his arms out, just twirling and twirling and twirling. And I thought, oh, God, I used to do this, you know. He likes the smell of gasoline and paint, you know. It's like, oh. But my son has taught me how to, he's taught me how to play. We do Legos together. We build volcanoes together. We make mountains together. We throw balls together. We go shoot hoops together. You know, he's taught me how to play and how to pray. He's got a real simple idea of God. And I've been able to make my amends to that Catholic Church and feel free to come and go anywhere. When I was 7 years sober, I stood here. I felt from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes like a complete whole human being. And that was from working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Clancy became my sponsor. I was about 9 years sober because my sponsor had to give up her sobriety. And I was so glad he was in my corner because I was like a newcomer that year. My marriage was falling apart. I was, when I was secretary of this meeting, I got pregnant, had a baby. It was a wonderful experience. Clancy became my sponsor, and I had a tough time walking through that divorce in the group. Nobody got custody of the meetings, but everybody's here tonight, and everybody's okay, you know? Al married wife number two, who's one of my best friends today. She's one of my best friends, and I didn't know that I would like somebody I just resented so much. But God can't enter into my heart when there's resentment and fear. I had to work on that, and Clancy helped me. He told me I was going to walk through that year with dignity and grace so I can be an example for others. And I have been an example for others. And there's been many examples here for me of things that I still have to walk through. I watch you, and I watch you good, and I'm there in your corner. I hugged somebody tonight whose mother has died. And I got to feel her pain and try to give her some peace. You know, and that's it. You know, she'll be there for me someday because we all have to walk through life. It's the adventures before and the adventures after. There's so many adventures here, but I'm full of life when I wake up in the morning. Casey and I got to go back to New Orleans. I get to date a man named Casey who's sober here a lot of years. And I have a lot of fun with him. And we get to go places and do things together, and we get to feel the gratitude of being alive and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would have no life without that. And he's got that deep gratitude, too, and there's a connection there. And we get to go places, and we are just wild about sobriety and learning things and being places. And we got to go back to New Orleans a couple years ago, and we got to walk the haunts again, and I got to take him to Antoine's. We went out for Robin's 40th birthday, and there we sat at Antoine's. I always wanted to go to Antoine's for dinner, never made it. And there I was with a man I love, and Robin was there with her husband, and Denny was there with her guy. And we had a private room with a sober waiter and a lot of fun, and we walked down Bourbon Street afterwards to go hear some blues. And I looked in those bars, and I looked down those streets, and I saw people throwing up, punching each other, passed out on the bar, dead-eyed. And I thought, seconds and inches between me and them. It's just a veil, you know, but for some reason, on August 20th, 1975, I gave up. In a quiet little voice, I said, I give up. And that's made all the difference for me because God was there for me. I've gotten to make peace with my past. And because of doing that, I get to look forward to my future. Today is a well-lived day. I got up. I said, whatever, God. And when my head hits the pillow tonight, it's going to say a lot of thank yous for the gratitude of being sober. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. That's what I used to think. And I found out that freedom is on page 25 in the big book. It's called There's a Solution. There's a solution if you're new here. I hope that you take your pack off and stay with us, because there's a great adventure if you do. Thank you.
The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore,
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. I am glad to be sober today. I want to thank Marilyn for asking me to speak in front of my home group. It is an honor. Lately, I've been having a bit of a rough time. Andy and I had taken for granted the fact that every Sunday someone would watch our son, who just turned 2 years old, so it allowed us to go to Sunday Night Ohio, which is one of our favorite meetings, as are all of these. And just something happened. My mom's, she's like 71 years old, and her knees were bugging her, and she said, oh, I can't make it. And then Andy's dad said, well, something's come up. And so like we were thrust back into what a lot of single parents know, a lot of what other people know is, you know, just babysitting. Well, you got to call a babysitter or else you'll have to switch off. So we've been starting to do this, but I'm spoiled. I'm used to my, you know, my three meetings a week and my little comfort zone, and it just shattered it. And you know, so I've been crappy lately. You know, I've been down like two meetings a week and stuff, and that's not enough for an alcoholic of my sort. God willing, next month I'll be 8 years sober, and some uninformed people might say, you know, you still have to go to those meetings, and, you know, lucky for those people that I go to those meetings, because, you know, you know, I still get crazy at times. Recently, I had a problem at work where I wasn't, as my sponsor said, practicing the principles in all my affairs. Apparently, I was acting unkindly to the people at work. I wasn't treating them well. I was, you know, sort of, I guess, condescending without getting into it. And so he said, okay, I'll tell you what, I want you to call me Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from work. And I haven't had to do that since I was, you know, like 2 years sober. And I'm thinking, geez, I must really be sick. And but he's right, you know, he's right. I just, I'm off the center path here, you know. I'm just sort of weirded out about everything. And when you're down to two meetings a week and you're used to three or four, it just threw me right off. So, you know, once I realize where it is I'm supposed to be heading and get going in that direction and talk to my friends and talk to my sponsor, I mean, I just feel so much better. You know, it's, things don't get better. You have to work at them. I was talking with Steve Z beforehand, and we shared the same sponsor for, for me it was 7 months. For him, I guess it was 4 or 5 years, I think. And I used to have to call him every day at the same time in the morning, 8:30 or so. And he was hard to locate. But once I got him, it was a standard, oh, so how you doing? And he'd say, well, I'm fine, and you? Well, and I'm pretty good, and I'd have all these things built up inside me, but, you know, I couldn't cut them loose in the beginning. I, you know, either I didn't have time at work or whatever. And Steve did that for 3 years, evidently, for the first 3 years before they changed that pattern. Some are sicker than others. Nothing personal, believe me. I've been in the car business in many different ways, shapes, and forms for about, I guess this is 21 years. Most recently now I'm reselling parts again on a wholesale basis, and I work for a big company. It's about an 80-mile commute every day. And before then I was working as a line mechanic for about 5 or 6 years. Before then I was a service writer for about 5 years. And then before then I was an auto parts salesman for a dealer, for a car dealer. You know, so I've been in and out of all these different things. People drink a lot in the auto business for whatever reason, but I just noticed there's a prevalence of people who drink in the car business, and I was one of them. When I was first married in 1976, and my marriage started to go on the rocks for a number of reasons. There was a miscarriage and all this other kind of stuff, and she wanted to go her way, and I wanted to go my way, and, you know, I was still drinking and smoking dope and being a dummy. And we had a lot of problems. I started drinking real heavily probably about 1978, although I drank a lot beforehand, you know, then it was pretty much nonstop. My first wife pretty much put an end to my rampant drug abuse, because she, you know, you can't be coming home with marks in your arms and staring at the walls all the time like this, you know. It's, honey, be cordial, you know. So in any case, I was drinking a lot, causing a lot of trouble, and she filed for divorce, and, you know, which is kind of a common thing to do, I guess, when you've had enough. And it really kind of tore me up. I didn't realize it until many years down the road, certainly until after I got sober, that, you know, this was one of the things that had powered me, you know, to be such a bonehead. And I continued to drink and use and whatnot. After I got divorced, I had a place up in Topanga Canyon where nobody could bug me. It was a big house. The guy that, one of the roommates, he had two jobs, so in the evening he was gone till like 2 in the morning. I got home and I had this whole place to myself. It was beautiful too. It was at the top of Fernwood Pacific. This was lovely. Coyotes howling at night. I had my dog with me there at the time. And as you can imagine, I got rip-roaring drunk a lot. And I had a couple of guns up there. I'd shoot them off whenever I wanted to, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, whatever. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd still be drinking, and everybody else in the house would be sleeping, and I'd rip off like 14 rounds on a .22. And I'd go, oh, this is great. You know, just release all these anxieties and everything. And the next morning, my roommate would say, like, we'd be having coffee, getting ready to go to work. He'd go, some idiot was shooting their gun out there last night. Did you hear him? And I was like, I must have been asleep. And I didn't hear a thing. And so it's just sort of the things you do when you're crazed. And to fast forward a little bit, I ended up, as I told you, as a service writer, and I had a job at a local dealer. And I was one of the fellows, when you came into the drive in the morning, they'd come up to you and say, can we help you? And I had this clipboard, and I would have a tie and a jacket and all that. And usually I was out the night before drinking or doing coke or both or whatever, you know, whatever, anything to get me from feeling myself. And I would breathe on my customers and whatnot. I would shake, can I help you? And I couldn't. It's funny now. and I couldn't sign my name, you know, correctly. It just was like a, you know, seismograph. And there was a woman that used to come around here. As far as I know, she's still sober. In any case, she worked in the parks department down there, and the thing I noticed about her was that, aside from other physical attributes, she had real clear eyes. And everybody I hung out with and everybody else who worked there had these, you know, perpetually glassy eyes all the time. Or else they smelled like alcohol because they'd been drinking. Or else they were doing this. They had a cold all the time. And sometimes traces of white powder on them. And that's a dead giveaway. And so anyway, I asked this woman out to lunch, and she said, sure. And I didn't know at the time. She called her sponsor and said, you know, evidently there's one of us working here, and he asked me out to lunch. And I guess she said, okay. So I went out and took this woman to lunch, and would you like a beer? And she's, oh, no, no. And so I said, okay. So I had like three tall buds, you know, usually what I have before lunch. And then I would drink during lunch and have a couple before I went in. And I took her out to lunch a couple of times. She never drank. She just annoyed the hell out of me. And I just, you know, you can't get loose without that juice, is what I'm thinking. And that was it. And in any case, push came to shove. She invited me down to a volleyball game down in Playa Del Rey at Faith's house, Faith M. A lot of you folks remember her. In any case, she was there. Karen C. was there. A guy named Philip. A bunch of people, all sober. And before I went down there, I called her from my house. I said, is there anything I can bring? You want me to bring like hot dogs or anything like that, sodas, you know, beers? And I go, no, 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 just, you know, bring whatever you need. So I brought a tall six-pack of Buds. And I didn't know all these people were sober. I had no idea. And I had one of those little lowrider beach chairs, and I had a towel and a blanket. I was all set up. And I got down there, and I set the chair up and everything, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and they're all playing volleyball. And I kicked back, and I opened one up, and I was having a great time. I was drinking, watching them play.
Turn tape over now, please.
I kicked back, and I opened one up, and I was having a great time. I was drinking, watching them play. And they're all like looking over me going, oh, man. And so we started to play, and I got crazy, of course. You know, I mean, you know how we are. Well, alcoholics who are athletic, we're crazy. We run around, you know, and bang into people. And she wanted to know, do I want to go down to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, oh, what the heck. And I went down there. I ended up meeting a lot of people from the class of 86, which is the class I got sober in. I agree. And we used to, in the first year, we did everything we were told to. Aside from listening to the sponsor and calling him every day, we did every watch that we were expected to go to, every move, every five-year party, every 10-year party, whatever it was. We stayed late when we were supposed to stay late. I just did everything I was asked, mainly because they told me that this place specifically was the last house on the block. And I didn't know. I mean, all I knew is that I couldn't go anywhere else. I'd burned out all my friends. I'd burned out, you know, my friends' parents, you know, who once thought I was a nice guy until I either, you know, went out with their sons or dated their daughters. And they said, we don't want that creep around here anymore. And I was extremely lucky to find the Pacific Group. You guys have been just, you know, my second family. You know, it's just, I can't tell you, you know, what kind of life I have around here. As the saying goes, if I had written a script 8 years ago about what I had intended for myself, I certainly would have cut myself short. Andy and I, as you may or may not know, have a 2-year-old son, Christopher, that we're just wild about. We're just, you know, God, is this our kid? And we can't believe it all the time, you know. He's just, you know, and it doesn't bother me. I don't mind changing his diaper, you know, whatever it is I have to do. I'm in, oh, God, this is my kid. I actually did it, you know. It's like, I had no idea this was going to happen, you know. I had no idea. In any case, I know it sounds funny, but you guys are all to blame. And I want to thank you for asking me to be a 10-minute speaker and allowing me to be in the Pacific Group. I love it here. Thank you.